This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
Wallace was an incredibly active, perhaps most engaged and powerful vice president in history, but he had a lot of battles with people within the administration. And as Roosevelt's third term came to a close, and as the choice of a ticket to seek a fourth term came into play, Wallace was bumped off the ticket by the big city bosses and a lot of the party elites, because he envisioned a post-war struggle for economic and social and racial justice in the U.S., which he was very explicit about.
A conversation on the rise and the fall of Henry Wallace. It's part one of a two-part series that we are doing on the history of the Democratic Party. Our guest is John Nichols. He is the author of the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says militarized federal agents who attacked and detained protesters, the media, and legal observers will begin what she called a phased withdrawal from Portland tomorrow. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf said in a statement the plan agreed upon with Governor Brown over the last 24 hours includes what he called a robust presence of Oregon State Police in downtown Portland. Before departing for a trip to Texas, President Trump insisted this morning federal forces wouldn't leave Portland until local authorities secured their city. Trump called the Oregon governor and Portland mayor weak and said if they don't, quote, clean out Oregon, we're going to do it for them. The nightly Portland protests began after George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police and have grown to include the presence of federal agents in Portland and other cities. President Trump today defended his decision to promote Dr. Stella Emanuel, who pushed hydroxychloroquine as a cure for the coronavirus and said wearing masks isn't necessary. Trump said he was, quote, very impressed with her and other doctors that stood with her. He lashed out at the social media for labeling her comments misinformation and removing the video that featured her. Trump returned to his promotion of hydroxychloroquine despite its disavowal, even by his own Food and Drug Administration. Emanuel has made several outlandish and bizarre claims, including that alien DNA is used in medication and that dreaming about having sex with demons causes physical problems. She has also said that reptiles and other aliens in part run the government. Trump abruptly ended his press conference yesterday when questioned about Emanuel's past statements.
She's also made videos saying that doctors make medicine using DNA from aliens and that they're trying to create a vaccine to make you immune from becoming religious.
Well, maybe it's the same, maybe it's not, but I can tell you this. She was on air along with many other doctors. They were big fans of hydroxychloroquine. And I thought she was very impressive in the sense that from where she came, I don't know which country she comes from, but she said that she's had tremendous success with hundreds of different patients. And I thought her voice was an important voice, but I know nothing about her.
More than 4 million people in the U.S. have been infected by the coronavirus, and the death toll in this country is nearing 150,000. California and Florida reported record high deaths yesterday, with 172 dead in California, 186 in Florida. Altogether, more than 1,200 U.S. deaths from COVID-19 yesterday, the largest number since May. Politico reports that Texas Republican Louie Gohmert, who has often refused to wear a mask, has tested positive for the coronavirus. Gohmert took part in yesterday's lengthy House Judiciary Committee hearing that featured testimony by Attorney General Bill Barr. The online publication The Hill said Gohmert walked around his colleagues in the hearing room and outside it without a mask. It said he also had a conversation with Attorney General Barr during which neither wore a face covering. Gohmert was scheduled to travel with President Trump to Texas and was tested ahead of that trip. High-stakes talks are resuming today on the next federal coronavirus aid package after no progress yesterday. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called the House Democrats' $3 trillion relief plan a loony ideological fantasy, all the while acknowledging the deadly toll of the virus.
More Americans are dying every day. Millions and millions are unemployed. And the institutions of American life cannot stay totally shut down until our race for a vaccine hits the finish line. Our nation needs to smartly and safely reopen while keeping up the medical battle. We need to get kids safely back to school and adults safely back to work.
McConnell will need Democratic votes to get a measure through the Senate, as a substantial number of Republicans are unwilling to vote for another major relief bill. One of the nation's largest teachers unions is authorizing its members to strike if their schools plan to reopen without proper safety measures in the face of the pandemic. The American Federation of Teachers represents 1.7 million school employees. The union's president blasted President Trump for pressuring schools to reopen even as the virus continues to surge. Randy Weingarten said Trump's response has been chaotic and has left teachers afraid.
How dare President Trump tweet, in all caps, schools must open in the fall, with no plan, no funding, and no idea what he's talking about. The hypocrisy of canceling the GOP convention in Jacksonville, Florida, because of the risk to GOP delegates gathering in that Florida hotspot, yet in the same breath demanding that children and teachers gather in schools in that same hotspot. Why would anyone trust President Trump with reopening schools when he has mishandled everything else about the coronavirus?
The American Federation of Teachers says school buildings should open only where coronavirus infections are low enough, there's adequate testing, and if schools enact public health safeguards like cleaning and ventilation, as well as physical distancing. The Trump administration says it will reject new applications and shorten renewal periods for the Obama-era DACA program that shields young undocumented immigrants from deportation. The move is a defiant stance after the U.S. Supreme Court refused to let the administration end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The Trump administration announced yesterday it will deny all new applications, limit renewals to 1 year instead of two. Immigrants' rights advocates blasted the move as cruel and illegal. Attorney Mark Rosenbaum told the New York Times advocates have no choice but to go back to court. Rosenbaum said the administration's attempt to overturn the DACA program was illegal the first time, and now it's a constitutional crisis. He said, quote, it's as if a Supreme Court decision was written with invisible ink. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we begin a two-part series on the history of the Democratic Party. And we are not going to go as far back as, say, the early 19th century when the party was created with the rise of Andrew Jackson and all of its complications, though it would be worth doing that someday. But we are going to pick up the story during the Great Depression and New Deal era, which is arguably the most progressive politics we've ever had steering this country. And we are going to do it through the rise and fall of Henry Wallace, probably the most progressive member of FDR's administration, who was FDR's vice president for 4 years, and who was removed from that position by the Democratic Party when it became clear that FDR didn't have much time to live. For this conversation, we're joined by our very good friend, John Nichols of The Nation magazine. John Nichols is the author of the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John Nichols, thank you for your time and congratulations on the new book.
It is a great pleasure to have done it. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
You focus a lot on Henry Wallace. As we begin, can you just give us a biographical sketch of what's important to know about him?
Henry Wallace was a farm editor from Iowa, born and raised into a prominent farming family. And he was a liberal Republican who was very much influenced by the impact of the Great Depression and broke with the Republicans to endorse Franklin Roosevelt for president in 1932. Roosevelt was so impressed with Wallace's knowledge of farm country and his ideas about big, bold responses to the Depression that he made Wallace his Secretary of Agriculture. From there, Wallace really became a central figure in the New Deal, serving with Roosevelt throughout the entire time that Roosevelt was in the presidency. But in 1940, he moved out of the Department of Agriculture to become Roosevelt's second vice president. And bringing Wallace in as vice president was a huge deal because Wallace was extremely progressive, far to the left of the previous vice president, John Nance Garner, and also far to the left of many of the people in the administration. It was a clear signal that Roosevelt wanted to move the administration to the left for a couple of reasons. One, because there's still a tremendous amount of work to do on the New Deal. Two, because they knew that World War II was coming and that the fight against fascism would require a uniting of a lot of folks in the U.S. Wallace was an incredibly active, perhaps most engaged and powerful vice president in history, but he had a lot of battles with people within the administration. And as Roosevelt's third term came to a close and as the choice of a ticket to seek a fourth term came into play, Wallace was bumped off the ticket by the big city bosses and a lot of the party elites because he envisioned a post-war struggle for economic and social and racial justice in the U.S., which he was very explicit about. And what I argue in the book is that bumping Wallace off the ticket in 1944 was the beginning of a pattern of compromise in the Democratic Party that in many senses continues to this day, and that those compromises have been very, very damaging to the party. And so I use Wallace as a vehicle to explore, political compromise, political caution, and also, frankly, to reintroduce people to an incredibly remarkable figure in our history.
Describe for me his politics.
Yeah, Wallace was an interesting guy. I mean, because over the period of his time in the New Deal and after the New Deal era, when he ran as an independent candidate for the presidency in 1948, because in those times he worked with many people on the left, including members of the American Communist Party, he's sometimes dismissed as a communist or an extreme leftist. He wasn't that. He was actually a progressive capitalist. In fact, a very, very successful businessman, a very creative businessman. And his vision was, I think, best understood as being in line with what you saw in the post-war era in Scandinavian social democracies, perhaps in the United Kingdom. That's a real rough calculus there. But he believed very, very strongly in economic and social and racial justice. He believed in FDR's Economic Bill of Rights and in the Four Freedoms as really essential building blocks for domestic and foreign policy. On domestic policy, he was very passionate about addressing racism. And this really made him something of an outlier in the administration and frankly in Democratic politics in the 1940s. He was determined to go all in on eliminating Southern segregation, the poll tax, discrimination, not just in the South but nationally. He was also very concerned about sexism and talked a lot about the need to enact an equal rights amendment and to protect the women who had gone into the factories during World War II. And finally, his vision for the economy was anti-monopolist. He believed that you had to break up the big corporations, dial down the influence of Wall Street. And that was a deep passion of his, sort of rooted in Midwest populism. As regards foreign policy, he believed that a Cold War could be avoided. He was, like Roosevelt, skeptical of the Soviet Union. He had many, many doubts and many, many concerns about Joseph Stalin. But at the same time, he did not want to move into a Cold War setting where the resources of the United States and frankly the world would be poured into a military industrial complex. And he was so passionate about that, that ultimately he would break with the Democrats in the 1950s and support Dwight Eisenhower for the presidency because of Eisenhower's concerns about the influence of the military industrial complex. So that was a deep passion of his.
How does Henry Wallace get to be a part of FDR's administration?
Well, that had a lot to do with Wallace's work in farming and in the farm sector. He was the editor of something called Wallace's Farmer. And I know that in the contemporary era, people probably have a hard time imagining how influential farming and agriculture was in the early part of the 20th century. But at that time, a tremendous number of Americans still lived and worked on farms or lived and worked in the agricultural sector. And Wallace's Farmer was viewed, especially by Midwestern farmers, as the champion of the working farmer, of the small farmer. It was a kind of full-service magazine that advocated for political solutions that were good for farmers, including parity and you know, fair prices. At the same time, it had a human side to it, you know, with, you know, lifestyle components and advice and counsel, etc. So it was a beloved magazine. It had been edited by his father as well. And to give you evidence of how influential it was, his father served as Secretary of Agriculture in two Republican administrations. And Henry Wallace himself was probably destined to do the same, might well have been a Republican Secretary of Agriculture in the 1930s or 1940s, there before the Great Depression. And the Great Depression was so devastating in farm country across the United States. I think many people are well aware of the devastation that it caused in our cities. But in farm country, in many ways, it was even more overwhelming because of the isolation and because of certain, you know, climate realities, that including the Dust Bowl and things of that nature. And so a tremendous number of farmers lost their farms because they were already in debt. The 20s had not been that good. And also they were forced to leave their farms to move, the great migrations out of the South to the North, out of the Midwest and out of the interior West to California and other states. And so it was a very, very turbulent moment. This troubled Wallace immensely, but he also saw it as a time in which big changes had to be made. And so he endorsed Franklin Roosevelt for president in 1932. That was considered a huge deal. Roosevelt valued that endorsement immensely. And almost immediately upon the election, Roosevelt offered the Secretary of Agriculture post to Henry Wallace with an expanded brief. Essentially, he brought Wallace into the administration and said, look, we want to do big things, and so we want you to be a part of the whole of the New Deal. And this Department of Agriculture in the 1930s became really the engine of the New Deal. It was where so many of the major initiatives either were generated or were interlinked with. And, if you think about things that we remember to this day, like rural electrification and, really the restructuring of many of our services for rural areas and many of our relationships with rural America that came out of that period. Also, Wallace had a huge hand in promoting things like Social Security and the Civilian Conservation Corps and all sorts of other initiatives that weren't always in the Department of Agriculture. But because Wallace was such an ardent and effective communicator, he became in many ways the spokesman for the New Deal.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with John Nichols, author of the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John, an important part of your story is how he was removed as vice president in 1944. But before we get there, let's talk about Henry Wallace becoming the vice president. Was it as controversial with the party as his removal would be?
In many ways, it was. Wallace, by 1940, was identified as, I want to be careful about this comparison because it's not quite precise, but as a sort of a Bernie Sanders figure. Think of a person on the left who is the most prominent left figure within the party. That's what Wallace was. And so when Roosevelt decided to seek a third term. He knew this was a big demand. No president had ever been elected to a third term. He also knew that the country was in a perilous position. You had the rise of fascism in Europe, the oncoming prospect of a world war. You still had many of the challenges that lingered from the Depression. And so Roosevelt knew that he needed to reorganize his administration. And he also, frankly, needed to make a case for himself as a third-term president. He was going to face a dynamic young Republican opponent in Wendell Willkie, who had come out of nowhere in many senses and claimed the Republican nomination as a very vigorous, very frankly liberal Republican. And Roosevelt was looking for a way to, improve the ticket, if you will. And so he reached out to Wallace. That did not sit well with the big city bosses, nor did it sit well with the Southern segregationists, who were still a huge influence in the party, because Wallace had already signaled a much more pro-labor, pro-civil rights stance. And so Roosevelt had to do something quite fascinating. He had to tell the 1940 Democratic National Convention, which was all organized to renominate Roosevelt, that if they didn't put Wallace on the ticket, he wouldn't run either. And because Willkie was such a dynamic candidate, there really was a fear that not having Roosevelt as the nominee, the party could lose its power. And so it was agreed that Wallace would join the ticket, a big power play by Roosevelt. And Wallace proved to be an incredibly effective campaigner. He went out on the campaign trail. Remember, Roosevelt had some physical challenges. Wallace did not. He was younger. He was an incredibly vibrant, very athletic figure, traveled the country energetically. And frankly, in 1940, the ticket just swept to victory, easily defeating Willkie and the Republicans.
Wendell Willkie is an interesting character in your book, someone you write a lot about. What was it that FDR was worried about Wendell Willkie taking away some of his support from the left? That's why he went with Wallace?
Well, I don't think initially it was. I think it became more of an understanding. Initially, it was just Willkie's dynamism. Willkie was an incredibly charming guy from Indiana. He'd made quite a bit of money in business, but still maintained a very kind of small town populist character that went over well. I mean, he was like a Jimmy Stewart kind of figure, with a little bit more pizzazz, perhaps. Willkie did, intriguingly enough, evolve toward a very, very liberal position. In fact, the reason I write a lot about Willkie is to illustrate something that was happening in the 1940s, and frankly, something that was lost. In the 1940s, during World War II, a group of African-American leaders led by A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, as well as a number of African-American newspaper publishers and communicators and artists, people like Langston Hughes, were arguing for what was referred to as the Double V campaign, victory abroad and victory at home. Willkie embraced it quite passionately. In fact, he wrote a book called One World in which he argued that the United States had to win World War II and then it had to come home and set its own house in order. Particularly as regards race, but also as regards gender and a host of other issues. And Wallace shared that passion. And so the reason I write a lot about Willkie, as well as A. Philip Randolph and many other figures, including Langston Hughes, is because I wanted to capture a sense of what people believed was possible then. And it's something that's been lost, really stolen from our history, is that in the mid-1940s, there was a belief that we could make a great leap as regards racial justice and gender equity in the United States. There really was a bipartisan Republican and Democrat grassroots as well as somewhat institutional movement for change. And that's really what came to a head with the fight for the vice presidential nomination in 1944. Both Willkie and Wallace were in play in 1944. Willkie sought the Republican nomination again and was defeated overwhelmingly by the conservative Republicans who didn't want his very, very liberal vision to come to power within that party. So then the last avenue forward politically was Wallace, and Wallace getting the vice presidential nomination at a time when Roosevelt was quite ill, and many people believed that Roosevelt's running mate would very possibly become the next president of the United States. And so that fight for the Democratic nomination in 1944 was really the great struggle over whether this sense of possibility about progress on race and gender and other issues might be realized.
This all happens at the convention.
Yeah. And in fact, you and I are talking at the end of July in the year 2020. It was at the end of July in the year 1944, and on a specific night when the convention, they first renominated Franklin Roosevelt, right? And then this is the way it usually goes. You nominate the presidential candidate, then you nominate the vice presidential candidate. And Wallace was so on the outs with the party bosses that they pretty much didn't even want him to be near the convention. But Roosevelt and other people, prevailed, and it ended up that Wallace was allowed to give Franklin Roosevelt's seconding nomination speech. If you can imagine that, usually the seconding speeches nobody even pays attention, right? But Wallace was given this platform, and he arrived in Chicago where the convention was held, carrying his own bags, getting off the train. Went to dinner with a friend. The friend asked him, "Well, what are you going to do? I mean, how are you going to do this?" And Wallace said, "Look, I'm not going to beg. I'm not going to, play any games here. I'm going to give a speech to the convention about what the Democratic Party should be. And if people go for it, then we'll carry on. If not, that'll be that." And so he really gambled it all on a speech. And the speech he gave was epic. It is, to this day, one of the most remarkable speeches ever given to a convention, not because of, just the pure oratory, but because of what he put on the line. And so effectively, he argued for a new deal, that the United States would win World War II, and it would come out of it as ambitious and energetic as it had been before, and that it would seek to realize the promise of the New Deal that had often been where it had often fallen short, to fill in the void and frankly, to raise it to a higher and better level. He spoke in that speech about racial justice. He talked about getting rid of the poll tax, getting rid of segregation. He talked about economic democracy and really creating a circumstance where there was a measure of economic equality as well as political equality. It was a very bold, very visionary speech, one that could be given today by a Bernie Sanders or a Jesse Jackson.
Is it possible that speech hurt him and his chances to be the vice president?
No, that's the incredible thing. I know. It's logical to think it would hurt when you're dealing with Southern segregationists and people like that. And I'm sure it did with them. But it captured the energy of the convention. Many of those people there had, kind of come up in the New Deal era. They had embraced Roosevelt's vision and the passion of it all. And the convention, Wallace gave this speech, and the convention went wild. It was an incredibly positive response. And so, amazingly enough, while it was a risk, and so, while it certainly probably did turn off some folks, the hall was electric. And when Roosevelt was renominated later in the day, there was a big demonstration, and that demonstration evolved into a demonstration to renominate Wallace as well, to just do it all. Let's keep this same ticket going forward. And Claude Pepper, who went on to become the great defender of Social Security in the 1970s, 1980s, was a senator from Florida at the time. He was leading the Florida delegation, and he was a strong, strong Wallace supporter, as frankly, many of the more enlightened Southerners were. They were battling the segregationists. And Pepper realized the moment, and he was a very small guy, but he started fighting his way toward the podium. And he knew that if he could get to the podium, the senator who was the chair of the convention and was at the microphone would let him speak. And so he was fighting his way through. It happened that the gate to the podium was controlled by members of the railroad unions, which were very strongly supportive of Henry Wallace, and they knew what Pepper was trying to do. So they opened the gate, and he started fighting his way up the steps. At that point, thugs who were associated with some of the big city bosses started pushing him back. There was literally a physical struggle to get up the steps. Wallace got to, you know, the edge of the podium. Pepper got to the edge of the podium. He was almost there, and the boss from Pittsburgh yelled, "Shut it down." The guy who was chairing the convention said, "I don't think I can. This they want Wallace. It's too impassioned, too intense here." And the Pittsburgh boss, very powerful guy, you know, literally was screaming, "Shut it down." And so finally, the chair of the convention, as Pepper got almost to the microphone, said, "I've got a motion to, you know, close the convention for the evening." And the crowd roared its boos. It was clear, overwhelmingly, the crowd did not want to shut the convention down. But the chairman said, "I hear a majority in favor of, you know, closing the convention for the evening." He gabbled it down, and they basically shut down the music, shut down the lights, and that was the end of the night. Pepper didn't make it to the microphone. Over the course of the next 24 hours, the party bosses and their allies restructured the ticketing for the convention. Tickets that were supposed to work for the next night or for the next day didn't. And they also engaged in incredible levels of deal making, promises of jobs and of, you know, political support and political alliances, all on behalf of their candidate, Harry Truman. In the first vote the next day at the convention, Wallace still got the most votes for vice president. More people favored him than favored Truman, but you had to get, you know, a clear majority, super majority there. And so they kept having additional ballots. And as the additional ballots went on, the deal making continued, and Truman ultimately prevailed. He became the vice presidential nominee.
Why? I mean, why did that outcome occur?
Well, I think it was simply no question. Henry Wallace promised that if he was the vice president, and if he were to succeed to the presidency, as many people, again, because of Roosevelt's ailing health, thought was a likelihood, the next vice president would probably succeed to the presidency. He promised no return to normalcy. He did not suggest that the United States would go back to what it was in 1932, or the start of 1933. He didn't say, you know, we're going to defend the status quo. And there were a lot of Democratic power brokers and Democratic elites who wanted that. They wanted a little bit of the New Deal, but they didn't want a New Deal. They didn't want to go forward ambitiously and with a visionary approach. I think they wanted to consolidate their power. They wanted somebody that they knew that they could work with. Truman was clearly that. He was a product of the big city machines in Missouri. Truman was not a horrific figure. I mean, some people try to paint him as awful. The fact of the matter is he was a go-along-to-get-along politician, actually a very typical politician of the era. But that's exactly what they wanted. They didn't want somebody like Henry Wallace who was going to push the envelope. And the end result was that you saw a consolidation of the position of the bosses and of frankly, the Southern segregationists as a force in the party. There would obviously be the battles that would occur going forward, but they dialed down the New Deal. There was simply no question of that. And it's interesting, too, that as this happened, the Democratic Party, instead of being more popular, lost popularity. It lost its energy. So in 1946, Truman lost his governing majorities or governing authority in Congress. The Republicans, you know, came to power and very quickly passed the Taft-Hartley bill, which weakened organized labor. They began to undermine other elements of the New Deal. And you saw the rise of the Red Scare. So in many ways, the plot or the scheming to consolidate their power didn't consolidate the power of the Democratic insiders. They ultimately undermine themselves. And this is a point I make throughout the book, is that again and again and again, the Democratic Party makes this bet that if they compromise, if they go toward caution, if they go toward centrism, or even a center-right approach, that somehow that will benefit them. And the evidence is not that at all. In fact, the evidence is that when they go cautious, when they pull their punches, a lot of people tend to give up on them.
It's remarkable to think how close we were to a Henry Wallace presidency. It would be less than a year after that convention that Franklin Delano Roosevelt died.
Yeah, it was. And really things, you know, Roosevelt's death was a tragic moment, you know, for the country, because remember, there's a generation that knew no one else as their president. If you were, you know, as so many young folks were fighting in the war or fighting or working in a factory, and you were in your 20s, Roosevelt's all you remembered as a president. And he had been this incredibly energetic, incredibly visionary president. And it was also tragic politically because Truman, again, not a horrific figure, but by so many measures, not up to carrying on for what Roosevelt sought to do. Wallace was the guy who proposed to carry it forward. And the party rejected him. And the impact of that was devastating.
That's interesting what you say about how people saw FDR. My grandmother says that. She was the president for like, you know, for as long as she could remember as a kid.
My dad, if I can just tell you, my dad at the, he was at an army base. He graduated, he finished high school and immediately signed up that day to serve in 1945. And he was at a military base and in New Jersey, I believe, preparing to ship out. And he said, when the word came that Roosevelt died, people were walking around the base like they were in a daze. They did not know what to do. They literally felt like, well, what do we do now? You know, I mean, how do we go forward without Roosevelt? And so I know it may be hard for people to imagine that, to put it into context, but even though he had been ailing for quite a while, his loss was profound. And it was profound for the Democratic Party as well. Roosevelt was not a perfect figure. You can list a ton of things that he did wrong, but there was with Roosevelt a sense that what he did wrong might be made right, and that there was a sort of a sense of constant progress. And that just didn't necessarily hold true with Truman.
Well, a couple of things that I think we'd probably agree that Roosevelt did wrong was, number one, the internment of Japanese Americans. Mm-hmm. Number two, and this is before, but, you know, getting the New Deal in order to get to Southern Democrats to support the New Deal, there needed to be Jim Crow you know, laws that were a part of that. Henry Wallace is certainly a part of the administration during this period of time, and even vice president during the internment of Japanese Americans. For somebody who was anti-racist and anti-fascist, did he ever speak out about these things?
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely on the race issues a strong advocate within the administration, and particularly a strong advocate for working class and poor folks across different groupings. But as I write in the book at some length on the internment, he did not speak loudly enough. He was flawed. And like so many people in the administration at the time, what is important about Wallace in this regard is that he came quickly to realize how wrong it was. And by the, you know, later 1940s, he was talking about Japanese internment as something that was horrific and one of a long list of things where the United States had fallen dramatically short of its supposed promise as a country. So he became a sharp critic of it. I read a lot on it. I don't see any evidence that he advocated particularly for it, but I also do not see sufficient evidence that he advocated against it. So I'm not going to, and I don't want to try and paint him as some sort of hero in that regard.
He would run for president in 1948, garnering a lot of enthusiasm, though perhaps not many votes. Tell me the significance of the run of Henry Wallace for president.
Well, I write about it a bit in the book. It was an incredibly poetic campaign. He was supported by Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein and Frank Lloyd Wright and a young Betty Friedan and a young Howard Zinn and a young Noam Chomsky.
It's a pretty good
list. Harry Belafonte.
Yeah.
If you can imagine, it was quite a remarkable campaign. Pete Seeger traveled with him singing songs at the rallies. Paul Robeson did as well. By the same token, he chose to run as an independent without creating a effective independent political grouping that was big enough or strong enough to really break the two-party system. He had the support of, as I mentioned, a lot of prominent folks. He had the support of a lot of communists. He had the support of some folks in labor, et cetera, et cetera. But it never really gained the traction that it should have. And frankly, I argue in the book that because of the overwhelming barriers to doing third-party politics in America, not because I don't like third-party politics, I'm quite a fan of it, but because of the overwhelming barriers, Wallace would have been smarter to fight for the Democratic nomination against Truman. He probably would have lost that fight, but he would have put down a marker within the Democratic Party for future fights. I think running the independent campaign just didn't work, and there's no way to suggest differently. But frankly, by that point, Wallace was furious with the Democratic Party. He felt that it had let down the New Deal, let down a vision for post-war peace, which he felt was incredibly important. And so he mounted the third-party campaign. He got around 1 million votes, got his strongest votes out of New York City and L.A., also, intriguingly enough, from Cuban-American tobacco workers in Tampa and, solid votes out of Jewish and African-American areas and some places around the country, and a pretty good vote out of rural North Dakota, where there were still some populist farmers. But it was not to be. And after that, he was pushed into the political wilderness. He was portrayed as, in the most negative ways, as either a fool or a dupe or whatever. Democrats didn't want him around, didn't want his supporters around. Fascinatingly enough, while the same year that Wallace went out on the left, Strom Thurmond and the segregationists went out on the right, and yet the Wallace folks were marginalized. They were pushed out of the party. And Wallace ultimately, as I mentioned, ended up supporting Dwight Eisenhower in 1956 because he believed Eisenhower would do more to address racism and because he believed that Eisenhower would do more to maintain peace. Ultimately, Wallace made a little bit of a reconciliation with the party. John Kennedy had great respect for Wallace and invited him to the 1960 inauguration. Lyndon Johnson communicated with Wallace, especially about ag programs. And frankly, if Wallace had lived longer, he might have had his, his renewal. But he died in 1965 at the age of 77. His obit was on the bottom of the front page of the New York Times, and he was pretty much written out of history after that.
John Nichols has been our guest. John Nichols is the author of the book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John Nichols, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you, Mitch. And if I could just leave you one last touch on Wallace. In his last days, he lost his ability to speak, but he had a little tablet. And on his tablet, he died, or toward his death, he was writing messages about what a foolish move it would be to go and fight a war in Vietnam. So I guess my point on Henry Wallace would always be that he was an incredibly visionary figure who we do well to remember.
Concludes part one of a two-part series on the modern history of the Democratic Party. Today we focused on the rise and fall of Henry Wallace. John Nichols joins us again tomorrow.
for how this legacy over progressive politics in the party has been quashed, from George McGovern to Jesse Jackson to Bernie Sanders. This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I am going to spend our remaining time together that I have with you to pass around my metaphorical hat around and ask that you throw a little spare change into it as we are now in this radio station's summer fun drive. There are several pillars I want to talk about concerning this great tradition of public broadcasting, several pillars that public broadcasting rests upon. One pillar is education and educational material that is available to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. Another pillar is just trying to seek a better understanding of our world and a better understanding of each other. Another is giving voice to those who too often have been overlooked by big commercial media. And that gets me to another pillar, that being public broadcasting, being commercial free, not bringing you programming to try to sell you items or products or try to reach a corporate bottom line. Another pillar of public broadcasting is workers who donate their time each and every day at this radio station to bring you their radio programs, which brings me to the final pillar, listeners who donate money in order to keep the radio station going. All of these things I just mentioned are interdependent and linked to each other, but it's that last pillar I mentioned, that being listener support. Now, let me just say, we are broadcasting from home, and I think our connection for some reason is not this so well as we are sheltering in place this morning. So I can hear every now and then that I'm being that my connection is being disrupted. This is the perils of broadcasting from home during the time of COVID-19. But anyways, as I was saying, we have all of these pillars that public broadcasting are dependent upon. And it's this last pillar, listener support, that is really the fuel that makes the rest of it happen. Now, each show on this radio station tries to fulfill the mission of public broadcasting in their very own way. And there is not just one way of doing it, and there shouldn't be. Diversity in all of its manifestations is our strength, certainly not our weakness. Now, our way on Letters in Politics is to try to do it through education, but not education for education's sake, though I'm not against that, but education to help provide context to the world that we live in today. And we try to do it through this art of storytelling. And for us, that's the art of conversation. Now, wait, you might say, is conversation an art form? And if I go talk to the teller at the bank, are we participating in art? Well, I'll leave that to you to decide. But can a conversation be an art form? I would say, of course it can. When we do these shows, we are always looking for that narrative arc. We're always looking for a beginning, a middle, and an end, which always has a bit of jazz-like improvisation because you never know what's going to be said, and frequently you have to go off script, not in opposition to the story, but in actually developing the story that you're trying to do in real time. Yeah, I think it's a fascinating art form. Admittedly, and not a hard one. It's not rocket science, but it's what we do. And I hope you will support us in any way that you can. We are on live at KPFA in the Bay Area, KFCF in Fresno, and KPFK in Los Angeles. And your donation of whatever you could throw into our hat will go to your radio station. For listeners to KPFA and KFCF, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. For our friends in Los Angeles, listening to KPFK, that number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. I will be giving those numbers again, believe me, so be ready for it in the second round.
I want to be clear, though, as after everything I just said, as host of this radio program, I'm not the educator. I'm not the teacher. I am the student. Perhaps I am the student representative by being host and getting to ask the questions. You know, when I was in community college many years ago, and let me say thank God for community college. In my day, we called it junior college, but then that wasn't okay to say after some time, I guess. But thank God for community college, because I barely graduated high school. And my mom ended up getting one of those letters saying, your son may not graduate, because I didn't take school seriously as a young person at all. Not until I got into community college, where I found and came upon this passion for learning. And oddly enough, I ended up dedicating my entire life to it. Now, of course, I couldn't stay in school all the time because, frankly, I didn't want the debt that comes with it. So I got into radio to see if I Trent. Sounds like once again we are having dropouts. This is the perils of broadcasting in the times of COVID-19. And I was just saying there at the very end that, you know, if I probably lived in medieval times, I would most likely have been a monk who transcribed books by hands. Believe me, I think today I probably live a monkish life, though without the religion. Anyways, this is all to say, this is what we do. And this is the time that we come to you seeking your support. The number, again, is for KPFA listeners and KFCF listeners, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. For our friends in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. 5735 online at kpfk.org. We have about 8 minutes together in which we are trying to raise the funds to keep this radio program on the air. And we have one of our very good listeners, Joseph in Benicia, who is putting up $1,000 this hour as a challenge. And if we can raise that $1,000 in our final 8 minutes together, Joseph, it will really mean $2,000 for this hour, which would be a big boost for us and an opportunity for you to be able to double your donation to KPFA right now. So if we cannot make it, if we are unable to reach that $1,000 mark, we will have to offer Joseph his money back. So for KPFA listeners in Northern California and KFCF listeners in the Central Valley, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-4-APFA.org. And for our friends in Southern California listening to KPFK, that number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. And of course, this isn't an easy time to come to you asking for your financial support of this historic and important radio station during the time of COVID-19, when so much has been shut down, when so many people are worried about their own financial well-being. I get that. I'm one of those people too. Yet, KPFA and KPFK and KFCF are all three radio stations that operate in the world today as it is. And our ability to keep the programs and the radio stations on the air comes down to our ability to get back to this last pillar of what public broadcasting is, the fuel of public broadcasting, and that is listener support. When the fuel dries up, so does the programming. That's how it works. And this is a time in which it would be a tragedy for that to occur, because we live in different times right now that have different possibilities, both good and bad, for the future. This is a time when the envelope is being pushed in ways like we've never seen it before, that I would have never imagined to be possible before.
but it's happening. This is a time that who knows what's going to happen in the November election, but let's just play it out. What if it is a blue wave for the Democrats? Get complete control of the Congress and the White House during a dire moment like we are seeing right now, during a moment when we have seen a pretty significant shift in the Democratic Party itself. But of course, has its candidate, Joe Biden, somebody who has a long history of the bipartisan consensus of basically keeping things how they were. But that said, the dynamics are really fascinating. And you can rest knowing that this radio station will be pushing, if that is the scenario, come next year, come the new year. It won't be just, thank God Donald Trump's no longer in office. Let's go back to our regular lives. There's no doing that. We have passed the point of the no return zone. And we are going to need, if that's a scenario, it may not be the scenario, I'm just playing this out. If that's the scenario, we are going to need someone pushing from the left. And this is not the time for these radio stations to fold the way that many other newsrooms have that are dependent on advertising in this moment. But we're not dependent on advertising. It gives us a certain sense of resiliency. Times are never great for us. We're always barely just making it by. Even in good times. But here's the deal. We still need to have these fund drives, even though the times are difficult right now. And so if you are someone, that's okay. You could donate $25 or $50 or $100. Whatever you can do, you know how we do it around here. We ask for contributions according to what people can afford, what's within their means. So for listeners to KPFA and KFCF, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. And online at kpfk.org. We have 2.5 minutes remaining in this challenge that came from Joseph in Benicia. We have raised $350. We are $650 away. We're not necessarily asking one person to donate that $650 to get us there. Though if you did, be greatly appreciative. We're not asking for any of that. We're asking for just as many people who can donate, say, $100 or $50 or $25 or whatever it is, to go to your phones or go online and do your part. For KPFA, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, listening to KPFK, 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. We're now $450 towards that $1,000 challenge that Joseph had called in. It's an opportunity here for you to double your donation to KPFA if we reach that $1,000 challenge. So that's, you know, if you could donate $25, if we make it, that's like $50 to this radio station in a time that's very much in need. If you donate $100 and we make it, well, then that gets us to $200. But if we don't make it, we will have to offer Joseph this money back. And if he takes it back, it would be a pretty big step backwards for us. 50 seconds to go. For KPFA listeners, that phone number, and KFCF listeners in Fresno, 1-800-439 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that phone number is 818-35 online at kpfk.org. Well, that's going to do it for us. You can still get your donation in the next few minutes to have it count for our challenge. But for those who did play,